The Jodcast, without Nick and Dave, but with Adam Averson, Stuart Lowe, and Tim O'Brien. The Jodcast, May 2010 Extra Edition. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast. I'm Stuart Lowe, and joining me this time is Adam Averson. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
And welcome back to the Jodcast.
You've thanks. It's
not been on
while.
It for a few months.
No, quite a while now.
Well, you've been doing a great job of editing.
I've tried my best.
Last time on the Jodcast, we talked about our survey, and thanks to all those people who've responded, we've had 194 responses to the survey. 188 of you took part in our draw, and we have chosen a winner using a pseudo-random number generator to pick a number. Unfortunately, we can't tell you who the winner of that book is at the moment because we only have an email address and we don't want to read your email address out on the Jodcast. That wouldn't be very nice of us. So we will be sending an email. So if you happen to have an email from the Jodcast, make sure you open it. It's not spam. You may have won a prize.
And then you could let us know who you are so that we can tell people in the next show.
Exactly. And we'll be talking a bit about some of the responses we had to the survey a bit later on in the show, in place of the usual feedback section. Anyway, as we said over the music at the beginning, there's no Nick or Dave at the moment. Obviously, that's Nick Rattenbury and Dave Alt, in case you were thinking of any other Nick and Daves.
I can't imagine any other Nick and Daves.
No, neither can I. Dave Alt is actually away in the United States at the moment. He's on a grand tour of planetariums and other things. He's going around on an astro tour, which sounds like a lot of fun. So Dave won't be with us for a while, but hopefully we'll be able to catch up with him via Skype or something during the summer. Anyway, coming up on the show this time, Tim will be answering your questions, but first we have some more of those interviews that we recorded at the National Astronomy Meeting back in Glasgow in April this year. Okay, we've stepped away from the National Astronomy Meeting for a morning to go to the Glasgow Science Centre, which is an amazing building with an amazing exhibition inside by the looks of it. I'm here at an exhibition of photographs by Max Alexander, and Max is here joining me. Welcome to the Jodcast, Max.
Hello.
For the International Year of Astronomy last year, you created a series of photographs of astronomers. So normally we think of images of space and objects in space, and this exhibition, as the introduction from the Astronomer Royal says, it's to look at the creatures who ponder the mystery and wonder of the cosmos of which they are part, which is a very nice introduction to you. Would you just like to introduce the exhibition for us?
Okay. Well, these photographs were for the International Year of Astronomy. I studied astronomy at UCL about 7 or 8 years ago. I did a diploma in astronomy. And while I was doing that course, I thought it would be a great idea to do a series of photographs, a series of portraits of the leading figures in the broad cross-section of astronomers in the UK. When I found out it was going to be the International Year of Astronomy, I thought that this was a good opportunity. So I went through the Science and Society Award program at STFC, and they gave me enough resources and money to realise this project.
So the exhibition last year was in the Royal Albert Hall, I think, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah, the exhibition was exhibited at the Royal Albert Hall back in autumn for about 6 weeks, and we tried to reach a different demographic. Obviously, here we're at a science centre, and that's great, and a lot of these pictures very much fit into this kind of environment. But we did try to reach a wider audience, and the Albert Hall provided that wider cross-section. And I think there was as many as 100,000 people would have seen the photographs over that period of time when they went to see performances at the Albert Hall.
Right. Now, I've been having a look around, and you've got these photographs on your website. We'll put a link to that on our show notes as well, so people can have a look at some of them. I really like your selection of images that you've got here. Would you just like to just show us around some of your pictures in an audio tour?
Yeah, sure. Well, just as a general comment before we start, most of these photographs are interpretive to the astronomer's work. I've got some character shots here, but most of the pictures, I'm trying to introduce some ideas and some concepts from astronomy into the photographs and try and express what the astronomers do. I'm also trying to photograph them as individuals rather than astronomy as a wide subject, and trying to, you know, show these inspired people what they're doing, the leading edge of their profession. So the first picture here is of Roger Penrose, and he's on a spiral staircase at the University of Oxford at Lineker College. And part of the idea was his twister theory about black holes. I don't know too much about the hard science behind that, but I do know obviously his work, and especially in the 1960s with black holes. And so this to express of some of the geometry that goes into to black holes and spiral galaxies.
So just to describe it, you're basically, as a photographer, you're at the top of the spiral staircase and looking down through the centre of the core of the spiral, with Roger Penrose on one of the steps lower down below you.
That's right. We're right down on top. We're right on the very top floor. It's a very difficult picture to pull off because I've got to use a tripod, and it produces some difficult angles for the tripod to be set up at and for the camera to be leaning right out across the middle of the spiral staircase. And there's also there's a flash on him as well. His 9-year-old boy, who's also called Max, was helping me out for the day, and he was holding up the flashlight pointing at his father for the picture. So.
Right, very good. And just moving along, I think we've got Will Percival here.
That's right. So this is a picture of Will. He's looking, he's written some equations on a piece of perspex. They look back to front to us as the observer, but they're written the right way around for him. And he was very, very careful about how he wrote them out because he was worried that some of his colleagues, if he made any mistakes, that he would get caught out by his colleagues.
So it's more accurate than a Hollywood movie.
I think so. I believe so. But yeah, Will was great, and he's got his eyes closed in the picture, and it's quite, hopefully there's a bit of mood and character in the shot, and it's him contemplating his work and his equations.
And as we move along?
Okay, the next picture's of Herania Perez. Herania's holding a television, an old black and white television from the 1960s, and we've untuned it, and you can see the snow on the TV, and as a lot of you are probably aware, about 1% of the snow on an untuned television on an old analog TV is leftover radiation from the Big Bang, CMB.
Yeah, it's great that you can observe the beginnings of the universe from the comfort of your own living room.
Well, that's right. We try to introduce every idea down here on Earth as, you know, that we're connected to the universe out there. You know, the Earth isn't a separate place. It's part of the Milky Way galaxy. And I had that in the back of my mind for some of these ideas. The next picture is of Mike Cruz, and Mike is working on gravitational waves. He's very involved. I think he may be the UK principal investigator for LISA Pathfinder.
So gravitational waves, just to remind our listeners, are distortions in space-time, the fabric of space-time
that
stretch and squash space.
That's right, yeah. So, I mean, ripples in the fabric of space-time is how they were described to me. I worked with a professional astronomer, Ian Howarth, from University College of London, and we sat down and brainstormed a lot of these ideas. I had about 20 ideas in mind when I started out the project, and then Ian helped me develop those. And for this picture here, we thought about, and I said, well, tell me, Ian, how would you describe a gravitational wave? And just like I said before, they're ripples in the fabric of space-time. So I thought about water, and there's a picture here of Mike with, I've thrown a rock over his head, and he was unflinching as I did that. And then these ripples came out in the pond, and he looks quite angelic. It looks hopefully a little bit like a Giotto painting as well, with this big halo around his head. Perhaps also the idea of brainwaves as well is in there. But it's probably, to me, it's one of the most satisfying pictures, and part of that is the simplicity of it.
It's very simple. And did it take you many attempts to get that to land just behind his head?
I probably had about a bag of about 20 rocks, and we had to have the rock just the right size, and had to throw it out the right distance. I didn't have an assistant with me. It was actually drizzling at the time, and I felt like I was a bit like I was a hooker in the line out. I used to play rugby, but not hooker. So I had to throw it just the right height and the right distance.
And there's no splash visible, so did you get it very, very
quick? Well, I actually had to wait for 2 or 3 seconds for the ripples sort of to come out and to be a nice settled shape. It was actually, of the pictures I took, there's only really one that is spot on. Okay, the next picture is of Dr. Serena Vitti. Serena is an astrobiologist and working with prebiotic life at University College London. So I've got her in this chemistry laboratory, and she's about 8 months pregnant in this photograph. So we're obviously playing with the themes of life here in astrobiology.
Chemistry and biology together. And
that's right. And on the plaque here, we talk about stellar nurseries and the search for life in the universe, and we're trying to just introduce a bit of humour into the photographs.
Yeah, I must say, I really like, there is a vein of humour through quite a few of these that I really like.
That's right, I did try and introduce humour and wit into the photographs. Astronomy can obviously be a very difficult subject to understand, so hopefully that helps with connecting with the public. And in all these pictures, I'm thinking, is this too esoteric? Is it too specific to the science? You know, it's more about the audience than it is about the science. more about connecting to them, to what I'm trying to do. So this photograph is of Sean Pauling. Sean's at Sheffield University, and he works in the Bowlby mine.
Looking in the north of England.
That's right. The Bowlby mine's in North Yorkshire, and it's 1 kilometre down in an old salt mine, and it's an amazing place to go to. And they're trying to detect WIMPs. It's the search for dark matter. So
the weekly interacting massive particles.
That's right. They haven't apparently every day they ask him, "Have you found the dark matter yet?" These very tough Yorkshire miners, as he goes down in the elevator with them, but not as yet.
It's a nice simple one as well, because it's a very black background there, being down in a mine. There's a very limited light source. I think he's holding a torch, and did he actually draw the words dark matter written?
He did. This is a single image. It's taken, it's a 2-minute exposure. I've got the camera on a tripod, and we've got some marks on the floor down on the ground, and Sean has written those letters back to front. And he did a fantastic job. We've not done anything to that photograph. It's straight out the camera. So he did them back to front. He wrote them in two lines, and then he did a wave with his torch, and then I fired a flash at the end of the exposure. So it's all in one
shot.
So that's
how you got him illuminated and the movement of him writing. So how was Bowlby Mine?
It was an amazing experience. It extends many hundreds of metres out into the ocean, out into the sea. And it's an incredible place to visit. It's very humid, it's very damp, and a lot of burly Yorkshire miners walking around.
Okay, and then the next image is another quite dark image with limited light in it, which is showing us Professor Carlos Frank, who's a cosmologist and works on simulations of the large-scale structure in the universe.
So when astronomers look up at the night sky, they know they're only looking at about 4% of the stuff of the universe. The stars, the gas, the dust, is all the baryonic matter. And so here, the lit part of his face is about 4% of the frame, representing that normal baryonic matter. The unlit part of his face is around about a quarter, around about 23% of the frame, and that represents the dark matter in the universe. And the rest of the frame, about three quarters, about 73-74% of the frame, is the dark energy that astronomers haven't yet discovered what it is.
Yep. So there's increasing mysteries that we have as astronomers. It's quite embarrassing that we don't know about this vast majority, 96% of the universe.
Well, there's a lot of work that astronomers have got to do. They only know this very small percentage of what the universe is made of.
As we move up, we get to Tom Bowles, who's an amateur astronomer.
Yeah, that's right. Tom was the president of the British Astronomical Association. He's a Glaswegian, I think. He's certainly Scottish. I'm pretty sure he's from Glasgow. He was a professional man who, when he retired, he took up very serious amateur astronomy. And in the last 6 months or so, he's broken the record for the number of supernovae discoveries. He's broken Frank Zwicky's record from the 1930s, and he's getting recognised for that now. And it's a remarkable achievement. So I've taken a photograph of him at his observatory in Suffolk.
So we see his telescope in the middle of his dome, which is open. Looks like he's getting ready to observe.
That's right. Of course, he does all observing from the comfort of his house, but this is a picture of him before he's to set out on a night's observing. And it's quite amazing what he's done. He's with respect to the number of discoveries that he's made, and obviously he's in contact with a lot of professional astronomers, and they follow up on his work.
Well, amateurs do an amazing amount of astronomy, which is not true in many other fields of science. You don't expect amateur brain surgeons, but it's great that amateurs are now, especially with CCD cameras of the last 20 years, able to do so much.
That's right, and as you say, it's one of the few fields where that can happen. And obviously with citizen astronomy now, with the Galaxy Zoo and other spin-off websites from other fields of astronomy, it's really bringing in a very large number of the general public, not just people who are interested specifically in astronomy.
As we move along the selection you have here, we've got Andy Lawrence, who's a professor at the University of Edinburgh at the Astronomy Technology Centre. He's sat at a desk, he's got a radio on one side of him and a computer screen showing an X-rayed hand on the other side. And he's got a rainbow spectrum behind him in the background there.
Yeah, what I've got here is this prism effect, got from red all the way through to the ultraviolet in the background. Andy works at multiple wavelengths, and as an observational astronomer, I don't know all the ins and outs of what he does, but he works in a cross-section of astronomy. And so starting from the radio all the way through to X-rays and gamma rays. So we're just trying to express Andy's work in this photograph here with the radio, with the X-ray on the screen, with him holding his hand out like it is in the X-ray, and then the visible light behind him.
And as an astronomer, I really like the fact that you've got the red on the left side going across to the purple on the right side, the blues. So it matches up with where the radio and the X-ray are placed.
Yeah, this is actually two photographs, so I'm letting into all my little secrets now. But I've got a prism at home, and I photographed the spectrum of light on the ground on an A4 piece of paper, and then we brought that in as a wash and the colour behind him.
Right.
And when I took his portrait, I had a red gel on the side of his face to express the direction of that red part of the spectrum.
Yep. You see, you had me fooled there. I thought that I was assuming the red tint on the side of his face.
I've let the cat out of the bag.
Well, it's good to know these techniques. And then as we move along, we've got someone who we interviewed on the Jodcast a couple of years ago, Professor Jocelyn Bell from the University of Oxford, who is famous for discovering pulsars just 43 years ago this year. And Jocelyn has a lighthouse behind her in this image. That's quite appropriate, given that she studies pulsars.
Yeah, well, I don't know a great deal about the physics behind the pulsars, but I believe they act like a lighthouse. They talk about the lighthouse model of a pulsar, how it sends out a collimated beam of light, very directional, and if the Earth is in the path of that beam, then we'll see it head on. And so that's why I've got a picture of her beside Portland Bell Lighthouse.
So did you actually go there with Jocelyn to
No, Jocelyn, unfortunately, it was very difficult because I needed a fog to go through the light
of the
lighthouse to see the beams. And with her schedule, she couldn't come down. So it is a montaged image. It is two photographs. There was a long period of time we didn't have much fog in the UK, and I waited for a full 6 months.
I'm sure lots of people wouldn't believe that.
Yeah, I know. But for down at Portland Bill, we didn't have fog for a long time. So we finally got the call from a B&B that I'd stayed in previously, and they said that the foghorn has gone off. So I drove through the night to get down there for 5 in the morning to take that photograph.
And are the lights in the lighthouse the original lighthouse lights, or are they lights that you've put there?
No, that's the...
It's still a working lighthouse?
It's very much a working lighthouse, very much so. It's a dangerous coastline down there.
Right. I quite like this image because I instantly recognise the quote that it's depicting.
Oscar Wilde said that we're all in the gutter, but some of us are looking up at the stars. So I've got Alan Watson here, who studies cosmic rays at Leeds University, lying in a gutter and at Leeds University.
And this isn't a double image where you shot him separately. You actually had him lying in a gutter.
No, he is there. Some of his colleagues and students were walking by as he lay there and making some lots of sort of interesting remarks. But Alan didn't seem to mind at all. He just carried on and was quite nonplussed about the whole thing, really.
So were all the astronomers that you imaged, were they quite happy to be in rather strange-looking situations?
I did have to be very persuasive. It did take me a long time for a lot of these astronomers. A lot of them are very busy, obviously, and some of the reactions to begin with was that, is this guy to be taken seriously? And I think some of them even followed up at the STFC press office to make sure I was who I said I was. But almost all of them came on board. In fact, I found that the scientists, the astronomers I worked with are very creative people, and that I learned that in their job they do have to be creative. It's not all just about the science and the maths. And in many of these pictures it was a collaborative effort, not just with Ian Howard from UCL, but also the individual astronomers to narrow down, to converge on a particular idea and how we're going to execute it and how we'd pull it off. Some astronomers didn't want to do certain things. There's one I wanted to stand on a trampoline to express the curvature of space, and he didn't want to do that, so we did something else. But it was very much a collaborative effort.
Right. We have a couple of very famous astronomers and cosmologists and theoretical physicists. We've got Patrick Moore and Stephen Hawking. Both. I see Patrick Moore's in his study in his house, where he usually films the sky at night, with some TV cameras filming him. I guess that's to show what he normally does or is known for.
That's right. Well, obviously, it speaks for himself what he's done in his life with broadcasting and publishing. So I've got him surrounded by television cameras in his study, as you said. And I just had a very short 3 or 4 minutes between takes where I could get this photograph. So it was a very quick setup. And he's staring down the camera. He never smiles in his pictures. So he's got a very stern look on his face, but I think it hopefully expresses Patrick. The other pictures of Stephen Hawking, and once again, I didn't have a lot of time to take this photograph, but it's in at DAMTP, if I've got that right.
DAMT, yep.
At Cambridge University.
Well, now we reach Professor Jerry Gilmore, who is one of the first people we actually ever interviewed on the Jodcast, from the University of Cambridge. And there's an image from very high looking down on him. Would you like to just describe where he is?
Okay, this is taken from Cromer Pier in Norfolk, and Cromer's where Albert Einstein spent 3 months before he went to America in the 1930s. And we enjoyed a pint at the pub that he used to drink at there after we took this photograph. So in the picture it says, what I've written in the sand is, there are more stars in the universe than grains of sand on the Earth. And it is actually a statement of fact. They have actually measured a part of the sky and then extrapolated roughly how many stars there would be in the universe. I believe it's 7 followed by 22 zeros, which is more than there are grains of sand on the Earth. So it was a very, very difficult picture to take. Jerry had to be available, I had to be free, the tides had to be right, and also the sun as well. So it took a tremendous amount of planning, and Jerry did give up most of his day to be there for the photograph. I was quite nervous when I wrote that in the sand because I tested it twice before and once I got the spelling right. But we got it, and the tides were just right for 15 minutes or so while they were turning. And
so you didn't have the waves coming in and washing out your writing.
That's right. Well, we were far enough up the beach. Well, there was a storm the night before that changed the whole shape of the beach. So I was a bit nervous about this one day that I had with Jerry, but we got there in the end. And there's a picture next to Jerry. We've got these supporting photographs that go with each of the photographs, which describe the astronomer's work, and a small picture, which we've got here, of a globular cluster with hundreds of thousands of stars. And
Jerry is working on the upcoming ESA mission Gaia, which is going to be extremely exciting. It's going to measure the exact positions of stars more precisely than we've ever done before. The best quote I heard him say in our interview was, "The whole solar system will be oscillating like a jelly," as far as Gaia is concerned. And as we move along, we've got Professor Colin Pillinger, who's hopefully internationally known. He was the main person behind Beagle 2, but unfortunately didn't land on Mars successfully. But it was a plucky mission, and if it had landed, it would have done excellent science.
So I've got this picture of Colin is taken at Sandy Quarry in Bedfordshire, and it's a place where ESA actually tests some of the rovers, while the Bridget, I believe it's called, that's planned to land on the red planet. And also Beagle 2 was taken down here as well, so it does look incredibly like Mars. And I shot Colin here with very warm morning light, and he's dressed in a space suit, in a NASA space suit with his helmet. If you look really very carefully at the helmet, you can actually see a radio mast reflected in the helmet.
Well, the future of exploration of Mars, we will have a radio mast.
There's some trees as well, but we just decided to leave those in there.
Are these the real colours of the rock and the sand?
We did tweak it up a little bit in Photoshop. It is slightly redder than what we actually saw.
Because when you see it next to your smaller image of Victoria Crater by Opportunity, the colours are amazingly close.
Yeah, we did tweak it a bit, but the light was very, very warm morning light, and I was conscious of that photograph we're going to have next to it. But just to reinforce the fact that, you know, places on Earth can be incredibly like other places in the solar system.
Yep. And now we have someone who is internationally well-known, but primarily not because of his astronomy, because he's a rock star, and that's Dr. Brian May. We reported on him becoming a doctor a couple of years ago. And here he is, he's next to his guitar, and is this his telescope?
That's right, this is a telescope. It's made out of, it's basically a cardboard cylinder that he made when he was about 15 with his father. So I've got a picture of Brian in his house in Surrey, and it's also next to him is the Red Special guitar. It's a piece of British rock folklore, that guitar. He's written most of his music on it and performed on Buckingham Palace with it. So he also made that incredibly with his father when he was a teenager. It's part of a mahogany table in the fireplace, and there's a feedback thing on the side of it that's actually his mother's knitting needle. So these are two parts of his life together in one photograph, his career in music and also his interest in work in astronomy.
Excellent. And here we have another amateur astronomer, I think, which is Damien Peach, who images planets.
Okay, so I've got a picture of Damien here taken with a fisheye lens. And what I've tried to do, Damien is one of the world's best astro images of planets. And so I've used a fisheye lens, which has given us a complete circle of the photograph to make it look a bit like a planet. And the sky is looking quite marbled, like it would do from space. And it's really just a bit of fun and just a quirky photograph to show off what he does.
So in the evening, presumably, there's a very long shadow behind him.
Yep, there is. There's a long shadow from my tripod, and we had to take that out. He's an amazing astrophotographer. I mean, the work, I think it's multiple images he stacks together. I think they may even run in the thousands, and he produces these images which are...
One of his images of Jupiter next to the picture?
That's right, yeah, the picture here. I don't know where he took this photograph. He takes pictures from his backyard in Reading, but he also goes abroad to look for the best skies as well.
It's an incredible shot, that, I see, of Jupiter. I presume it's lots of images stacked, like you say. It's amazing the detail you can see in the cloud bands.
I mean, this looks like it's taken from a spacecraft, you know.
It really does.
10 or 15 years ago.
It looks like a Hubble telescope. And then we move along to Menino, Dr. Hayley Gomez from the University of Cardiff. And I like that you're keeping to sort of British sci-fi tradition here, using quarries and things. Hayley seems to be in a quarry as well.
Well, talking about sci-fi, this is taken just north of Cardiff, where they filmed Doctor Who. And so they're used to film crews going up there. So... Hayley's surrounded in a big cloud of dust here, and she works with gas and dust in the universe. That's in the interstellar medium. And so her husband's also, Ed Gomez, is a professional astronomer as well. So I've got him with a blower brush, and we've got this big pile of filler dust that's been put down next to her. And he's got this leaf blower kicking up this big cloud of dust. It was a very, very difficult picture to take. My Hasselblad camera was covered in dust. I knew it would be, and we only got a few frames. It was freezing cold in January, but hopefully it works and it's a bit of fun.
Moving along, we come to a solar physicist. This is Dr. Lindsay Fletcher, who I think we've also interviewed on the Jodcast as well. It's quite nice to see Jodcast interviewees being represented here.
That's right. Well, we've got a picture here of Lindsay Fletcher. They're not all interpretive photographs to the science. This is a straight character shot of Lindsay. And Lindsay's a solar physicist who has organised the National Astronomical Meeting this week. And it's next to the final photograph in the series here. It's of Sir Martin Rees, and there's a picture of Isaac Newton behind him. When I walked into his office at the Royal Society in London, he said to me, "Would you like to photograph me beside this portrait of Isaac Newton?" So I said that would be fine. I actually asked if we could draw the curtains over, because I knew the light would flare onto the painting, and he said, "Well, can we wait 20 minutes because it was the state opening of Parliament?" So I said, "Sure." So about 20 minutes later, the Queen was going by in her gold carriage, and he was in another office. So I called out, "Lord Rees, the Queen is going by now." So it was quite a surreal moment.
And I quite like the positioning you have of the picture behind him with Newton, because Newton is famous for the quote of saying his achievements were built on the shoulders of giants, and here he is standing on the shoulders of Lord Rees.
Well, I did mention that to him when I took the photograph, and he smiled when I said it. And I am playing with that idea and that image. I don't want to overstate it, but if people see it, that's great, and that idea will jump out at the viewer. The last tour of Bernard Carr, who's he works as a cosmologist, I guess, at Queen's Mary University in the Mile End in London, and I've got a picture of him reflected about 17 or 18 times in these. It's at Apsley House in London, Duke of Wellington's London residence.
So is this a real room that's full of mirrors?
Yeah, that's right. There's mirrors on both sides of the room, and so Bernard, it's a self-portrait, because otherwise I would have had to be in the photograph. And it's expressing his work with the multiverse, that there may not just be one universe, there might be multiple numbers of universes. He also talks about the quantum mechanical world of many interpretations. I think that's bound up in his work as well. And we're trying to express those two ideas of the multiverse in this photograph.
Multiple copies of him. And the final photograph in this selection here is of a very young astronomer.
This is Will Parker, William Parker, who's a 9-year-old boy from the south coast in Gosport, and I bumped into him about 3 or 4 times as I was taking photographs around the UK.
He wasn't following you then, either.
No, but he's a remarkable boy, and he really stood out in my mind. And I thought, well, you know, we've got amateurs in here, and he's an extremely keen amateur. Mm. And I got talking to him and his dad, and he wants to be a professional astronomer. So we used him as the last photograph in the series. And good luck to him. Hope he does it. He's extremely passionate about it. He's next to Stephen Hawking, and at 9 years old, he's reading Hawking's books.
Excellent. And he will hopefully be the future of astronomy.
So our listeners can find your images on your website, which is maxalexander.com. And we'll, as I said earlier, we'll put a link to that on our show notes. Are you also having further exhibitions around the country?
Yeah, it's travelling around the country. So after the Royal Albert Hall, it went over to the University of Utrecht in Holland. It's been at the Centre for Life in Newcastle for about 3 months. It's now here at the Glasgow Science Centre. And next will be Belfast, we hope. We're still confirming that. And there are several other locations around the UK as well. Science centres, but we're also trying to reach more public venues as well, like museums and so on.
Well, it's an excellent exhibition of images, and thank you very much for describing them to us on the Jodcast today.
And thanks for that, Stuart.
Now, as it's mid-May, we're coming up to the first anniversary of Herschel and Planck. They both launched on May the 14th last year, 2009. On an Ariane 5 rocket from French Guiana in South America. They've both been producing results. Now, Planck isn't due to produce its main results for another year or two, but Herschel has been producing a whole suite of results, and a whole bunch of papers just recently appeared on the Astronomy Archive about Herschel results. So I talked to Professor Matt Griffin from the University of Cardiff to find out more. Okay, we're joined by Professor Matt Griffin from Cardiff University. Welcome to the Jodcast, Matt.
Thank you very much.
And you're the PI, the principal investigator for the Spire instrument on Herschel, aren't you?
That's right. Yeah, the Spire team is a very large international consortium, and it's my sort of great pleasure to be the front man. They do all the work, and I can take all the credit.
So this week, a few pictures and results were announced from Herschel here at NAMM, the National Astronomy Meeting. Can you tell us about some of those results?
I can. The results we've seen this week are actually not much of an update compared to what was presented in the initial results workshop in Madrid. ESA have an embargo on any future publication of results until their own big show, which is in Aztec in early May. And at that meeting, there will be a huge array of new results presented. Today, what we saw is the same as in Madrid, with nicer versions of pictures and slightly more enhanced assessments of the results. And I can tell you that there's a lot more behind the scenes that we haven't seen yet that should come out in a big expose in early May.
Right. And so, because Herschel was launched last year along with Planck on an Ariane 5, it's producing lots of results, as you say. Which are your favourite things that we've seen so far?
Well, that's really a matter of taste. Herschel has something to offer everybody, from the solar system to the most distant galaxies. And our team and the teams of scientists working on open time data cover that whole spectrum. And I wouldn't care to say that any particular topic is more interesting than another. We all have our own personal preferences. My own is probably what Herschel is telling us about the large-scale structure and the life cycle of the galaxy, the beautiful images that we've seen of star formation regions and molecular clouds being impacted on by nearby stars and so on. All of those images contain a huge amount of scientific information, so they're not just cosmetically nice. And that's one of the things which I think Herschel is going to tell us most about, how our own galaxy lives and breathes. As I say, though, that's just my own personal preference.
And how long do you think Herschel will be producing results? Because it's got a limited lifetime, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has a limited lifetime. We already know with a reasonable accuracy what the lifetime is going to be, probably somewhat less than 4 years, which is slightly longer than the design lifetime, so everything's working fine. And because it's limited lifetime, then we have to be ultra careful to make sure that we use that limited time very effectively. And I think that's now happening. I expect that for most of the kinds of science that Herschel is doing, the legacy value of the surveys that it produces will result in a continuing scientific exploitation, very similar to IRAS, which flew a long time ago, but the data are still being used. That's what I'd like to see for Herschel, that the data will be a very rich resource for decades to come.
Will those data be easily accessible on the ESA website?
They will. One of the nice features of Herschel is that a lot of effort has been put into the data processing side during the preparation for the mission. That's one of the reasons why the quality of the data is so good so early in the mission. And it's very important to make sure that when the archive is created, that the data are very easy to use, that they don't require expert knowledge of the instruments or the calibration, that you can almost take what comes out of the automatic pipelines or what's available directly by downloading from the archive and do science on it straight away. And so effort is continuing to make sure that that's going to be the case.
And I noticed there's a very nice Herschel website that just gives you a picture of the galaxy with little boxes on showing you where the nice pretty pictures, the press release ones are as well.
Yeah, ESA have created this special website, the online Herschel something image archive, and there's a relatively small number of images in that in there at the moment, but as soon as the embargo is lifted, then I hope to see a lot more.
Okay, well,
looking forward to lots of new data and new results coming soon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Stuart.
So that was Matt Griffin talking in April this year, but there, as I mentioned before that interview, there have been a few results recently, and Adam, you've been looking at one of them.
Yes, so a recent picture released by ESA from their Herschel mission is a picture of a hole in space.
A hole in space?
Yep. So
this isn't a black hole then?
No, a hole where there's actually nothing, which is quite interesting. So the hole appears next to a bright region, NGC 1999.
So that's NGC, that's some kind of nebula probably. It's new general catalogue.
Yep, it's a region of bright reflective gas. And this hole has been known for quite a while. It's a dark region next to this bright source. So they thought originally it was a dense region of gas. So the dense gas is blocking the light, making it dark. Whereas when Herschel went to look at some nearby young stars, they discovered that there's actually nothing there. They expected them to see something at the Herschel wavelengths, but got nothing.
So because they thought it was some dark dust that was sat there, you expect the dust to shine
it
up.
It should be warm in the infrared, so...
Right, so Herschel should be able to see something really bright and obvious there.
Yep, and there's nothing. And so people have now pointed ground-based telescopes at it, and again, nothing. So it's an actual hole in space rather than a hole caused by something blocking the light.
Well, hole in space sounds terrifying to me. It sounds like a hole
in
space time or something.
We're not sucked into the void and be destroyed.
it's nothing to do with that crack in Doctor Who, is it?
No.
Good.
Luckily. So they think this hole's been caused by possibly the young stars that they were going to look at, because as stars form, the gas that they formed from gets blown away, and this is thought to be from jets of emission, of gas coming out from the poles of these stars.
So this is sort of like pulsars that we've talked about on the Jodcast before, where you have these jets of radio waves coming out.
Yes.
But in this case, these are jets of
matter.
Right.
Yeah, kind of like sort of, they're thought to start from winds, so they can be thought of kind of like that, which would just, as you'd expect, blow a hole in a big cloud of dust.
So it's a very, very directional wind from a star that's blown a hole.
Yep. But it could be more than one star, and they just happen to all be blowing in the right direction to create this hole.
So it's a hole from out on along the line of sight that we look through. So if you were somewhere else in the galaxy,
you'd see...
You wouldn't necessarily see the hole.
No, you'd see the edge of the cloud from the other side, I guess.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah. If you go to ESA and try and look up NGC 1999, you'll probably find the image, and it's very pretty, as all of the Herschel images are.
Well, we might put that as the show image.
Oh,
as a cover art on this show. That would be quite nice. Do they know if there are any other holes, or is this just a one-off that we happen to have
seen this is a
in the right direction?
So far, I mean, yeah, as you say, if you're not looking in the right direction, you're not going to see it, so...
Right.
We might find more, we might not.
Now, talking of missing things, or empty places, we've recently had an interesting series of images of Jupiter, taken by amateur astronomers around the world, showing the southern equatorial band, or rather not showing the southern equatorial band, because it's disappeared. There are images from last summer, 2009, that show the southern equatorial band, and this is basically a band of clouds that sit just on top of the Great Red Spot, or rather the Great Red Spot sits at the bottom edge of the southern equatorial band. It's gradually faded away, and if you look at an image taken quite recently, there's nothing there. That also, I wasn't aware that apparently it does this on a on a fairly regular basis, every 3 to 15 years or so, it just fades away and then comes back. We're watching the weather changing on Jupiter.
That's quite impressive. I've not heard of this cycle either. So
neither had I, actually, until I first read this on Emily Lakdawala's blog on the Planetary Society website. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Emily has far more information if you want to find it. Now we get to that point in the mid-month show where we put your questions to Dr. Tim O'Brien.
The first message we've got this month is from Ron Davison, who first of all says thanks for always putting on a great podcast, so thanks for that, Ron. But secondly, he wanted to send us some information that might be useful to the gentleman who inquired about astronomy for the blind in the last Ask an Astronomer I did. He says, if you listen to the March 6th podcast of 365 Days of Astronomy, which is on 365daysofastronomy.org, the presenter discusses how to watch a solar eclipse if it's overcast, but in other words cloudy, by using a chart recorder and a simple antenna and amplifier to monitor the radio emissions from the sun. And if you were to use an audio amplifier in addition to that system, then a blind person will be able to actually experience the eclipse hourly by listening basically to the radio signal coming from the sun that passes through the clouds. And he thinks that would be a unique way to experience an eclipse. So thanks for that, Ron. That's certainly worth a try if you've got the equipment, and perhaps we'll return to that in future, since we've also done that ourselves actually at Jodrell Bank with a partial solar eclipse that happened in 2008. So we might put some information up about that and return to it in a future episode. Second question we've had sent in from Mark Jones in San Antonio in Texas, and he says, when viewing an image of a galaxy as seen at an angle, such as the Andromeda Galaxy, to what extent is the image distorted by the fact that the galaxy is rotating and the light from the far side of the galaxy has travelled many thousands of light years further than the light from the near side? In essence, we should be seeing a lag in the rotation of the far side of the galaxy as compared to the near side. Is this correct? Is this lag long enough to cause a significant distortion in the image? Okay, an interesting question. Of course, the point here is that light travels at a finite speed, about 300,000 kilometres every second, which is pretty damn quick. But on the scale of a galaxy, it still takes that light, for example, in the Milky Way, it takes that light 100,000 years to cross the galaxy. And therefore, it's true to say that when you look at one of these distant galaxies, let's say the Andromeda Galaxy, which is the nearest large spiral galaxy to our own, then the light from the far side of the galaxy is taking several tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 years longer to reach us than the light from the near side. It depends on what angle the galaxy is tipped at relative to us. But it's certainly true that we're seeing the stars on the far side of a galaxy at an earlier point in time, effectively, than the stars on the near side. Now, typically, 100,000 years for the light travel time across a galaxy sounds like a long time, but of course, in general, many timescales in astronomy are very much longer than that. So, for example, compare it to the lifetime of a star. So the lifetime of the Sun on the main sequence, where it's turning hydrogen into helium, is something like 10 billion years. So 10,000 million years. So if you compare 100,000 years to that, this light crossing time, that's only 1/100,000th of the lifetime of the star. So you wouldn't expect to see any appreciable difference in the properties of a star like the Sun if you saw it, you know, if there was a star on the near side like the Sun compared to a star on the far side of a galaxy like the Sun. It would only be a very tiny fraction of its lifetime different. Even when you go to higher mass stars, let's say a 25 solar mass star, which burns its fuel faster and therefore has a shorter lifetime, its lifetime is still several million years. And even then, you're only talking about, you know, maybe 1 or 2% of the lifetime of the star. So it's getting a bit more significant, but still not huge. Now, returning to the particular point that Mark makes, which is the image of the galaxy distorted in some way? Because, of course, the galaxy's rotating. A galaxy like Andromeda, for example, is all the stars are moving on circular orbits around its centre. And therefore, if you're seeing the stars on the far side at a larger time into the past, looking farther back into the past than the stars on the near side, then maybe they're not actually in the same relative positions to each other. So there's some sort of shearing, some sort of twisting up of the galaxy as seen in the image that you see. The question is, how big an effect is that? Now, in fact, you know, my gut instinct was that it wasn't particularly a huge effect, just in the same way I've just discussed in terms of the fractional lifetime of the stars. But I thought I'd better check. And so I worked through a few numbers and worked it out for Andromeda, imagining, let's say, a star like the Sun at, you know, the same sort of distance that the Sun is from the centre of our Milky Way, which is about 8,000 parsecs, which is sort of 27,000 light years or so from the centre. Our Sun moves around the centre of our Milky Way at about 220 kilometres per second, something like that. So you can actually work out how far this star at the far side of the Andromeda galaxy would have moved relative to, say, a star at the near side. And it turns out that at the distance of Andromeda, it's actually offset by about 6 arc seconds. So an arc second's 1/3,600th of a degree. So it's a small angle on the sky, a very small change in the position of the star on the sky from where it would have been if they were all seen at the same time relative to the galaxy itself. But actually, interestingly enough, it's measurable because, you know, in an image that we take of, say, the Andromeda galaxy, then we might expect, say, an optical image of the galaxy seen with visible light, you might expect to be able to measure the positions of these stars accurate to a fraction of an arc second. Certainly atmospheric seeing blurs the star positions to maybe about an arc second across, but you can measure the positions rather more accurately than that. So 6 arc seconds is measurable, rather surprisingly, I guess. But of course, on the scale of Andromeda's several degrees across. And 1 arc second is, as I say, 1/3,600th of a degree. So it's a tiny distortion, although measurable. And of course, the real problem then is, what do you compare it to? How do you know what the galaxy structure would have been to compare these, you know, slightly changed positions with? There's nothing to compare it to. It's not like, you know, the galaxy's got some very nice straight lines drawn on it running out from the middle to the outside edge, and we can just see them start to curve a little bit as you see this distortion. So interestingly, it's a measurable effect for galaxies as close as Andromeda, but we wouldn't really, practically, it's hard to think of an example where it would matter, to be honest. So, interesting question from Mark. Next comment is from Miguel Werner, who wrote in from South America. And he was actually referring to these sorts of weird ideas that have been circulating about something strange going to happen in 2012. You know, of course, these sort of exaggerated conspiracy theories. But in fact, what he was commenting about was one of our news articles, which we released recently, which you might have seen on our website, which was about a mystery object in the Starburst Galaxy M82. And this was a story that a few of the astronomers here, Tom Muxlow in particular, have been monitoring M82, which is a galaxy with a lot of star formation going on in it. And therefore, because there's a lot of star formation, we call it a starburst. There's a lot of star death, the massive stars exploding in a supernova. So they've been monitoring this galaxy for many years now, in particular looking at it with radio telescopes, which lets them see through the dust in the interstellar medium right into the heart of this galaxy, where you can see where most of these supernovae have been taking place. And back in just over a year ago, back in April 2009, just the beginning of May 2009, a new bright point of radio emission appeared near the core of M82. So the suspicion, of course, was that it was a new supernova that had exploded and was producing radio waves. But the problem was that, having monitored that object now, it doesn't really behave like any radio supernovae do that they've seen before. So it was very confusing as to what this was, and it's still quite unclear. And one of the interesting features of this was that they, with Merlin, using the array of radio telescopes here in the UK that's spread across about 200 kilometres, were able to measure positions very extremely accurately. And we were able to measure the position of this object, and it appeared that it was actually moving sideways at a speed which, given the distance to M82, put the speed at about 4 times the speed of light. And this was mentioned in the press release that we did, and in fact, you know, discussed and explained. Now, what Miguel was pointing out was that actually there'd been some bizarre suggestions in some of the people worrying about what might happen in 2012, that maybe this object that had been discovered in M82 was actually going to crash into the Earth in 2012. Now, there's a few points about that, of course. One is that that even if something were coming all the way towards us from M82, it's actually about 13 million light years away, so we certainly wouldn't, even travelling at the speed of light, we certainly wouldn't have to worry about it arriving for some time yet. But also this sort of confusion, I guess, about things moving at an apparent speed faster than that of light, because of course what we're not seeing is that there's actually motion that's actually faster than the speed of light, it's just apparently faster than the speed of light. This so-called superluminal motion. And just to clarify what that is, if you imagine an object, let's say in this case, it might be that this one theory for what this mystery object might be is that it could be something like a microquasar, which is a stellar system with a black hole in it, companion star, materials falling in towards the black hole, and occasionally these systems eject material. They have outbursts in which material is ejected at very high speeds. Not faster than the speed of light, but appreciable fractions of the speed of light, depending on the object, maybe 0.7, 0.8, 0.9, even, you know, very close to the speed of light. And now if you imagine one of the sort of blob of material being shot out from the region around near this black hole, and if you imagine that blob sort of coming not quite directly towards us, but sort of at an angle to the line of sight, towards us, and then we sort of take two pictures and we measure it as we did with this particular object. We take a picture on one day, take a picture a few days later or a few weeks later. So when we come to calculate the apparent speed of this blob as it's moving, then what we're going to do is divide the sort of distance by time. But during the time we're between the two images, it turns out the blob's actually got closer to us. And so the time taken for the light to get to us from the second position is actually less because of the fact that the blob is closer to us. And when you allow for that, when you divide that distance by time, because that time is shortened because the blob's actually got closer to you, the speed that you get is artificially boosted, because you're dividing distance by time, you're dividing by a shorter time, so you get a larger speed. And you can actually just work that out and work out by what factor the apparent speed compares to the speed of light. And it turns out, for, you know, plausible values of the actual speed of the blob as some sort of fraction like 0.8, 80% of the speed of light or something, you can actually get particular ranges of angles at which it's coming towards you for which the speed you would apparently measure from the two images is some factor greater than the speed of light. So anyway, just to clarify, we haven't detected anything that's actually moving faster than the speed of light intrinsically. It just appears to be. And also there's certainly no way in which that thing is coming towards us that it's going to actually crash into us and cause some hideous problem in 2012. Okay, the next question we've got is from Martin, who hails from Dublin in Ireland, and he says, do you think my newborn child will see an unmanned interstellar probe being launched during his lifetime? How far away are we from launching such a mission? What are the main hurdles? I guess the propulsion is important, but what are any other hurdles? And when do you guesstimate an interstellar mission will be launched, if at all? Okay, I guess the first thing to point out about interstellar probes is that in a sense we've launched one, because of course several, in fact, the Voyager spacecraft are heading out of left the solar system now, heading out into interstellar space, not actually of course designed to be interstellar probes, but certainly going that way now. And if we'd sent something like Voyager towards the nearest star, but something like moving at about 20 kilometers a second, it would still take Voyager to travel to about 80,000 years to get to the nearest star. So I guess that's the first major problem with thinking about interstellar missions, is that at the sorts of speeds we've built spacecraft to travel at so far, it's, you know, ridiculously long amounts of time. Now, it doesn't mean to say you can't send them out there, and indeed they are going out there now. But I suppose the big question would be why? You know, what would be your motivation for doing this? Normally, I guess most of us are motivated by things that occur on our human timescales, in other words, within our lifetime. So we'd like to, we certainly don't often get PhD students who want to start doing PhD projects from which they won't see the result for 80,000 years. So, you know, I think that would be one big motivator. Why would we bother to send out an unmanned interstellar probe for which the results would not be returned for many, many thousands of years? Now, one issue that's obviously often discussed is that if one tries to do things faster, travel faster, so travel at speeds approaching that of light, then we get this effect called time dilation, which is a consequence of Einstein's special theory of relativity, which means it's commonly known as moving clocks run slow. So from the point of view of an occupant of a spacecraft which travels at a very high fraction of the speed of light, it actually, for them, it takes less time for them to travel these distances. So, for example, if you were to imagine a spacecraft traveling at 0.995 the speed of light, and they were traveling, say, 10 light years, from a point of view of someone on the Earth, that would take them about 10.05 years, so just over 10 years because they're traveling a little less than the speed of light. But from the point of view of any occupant of the spacecraft, they'd actually only age just over a year, 1.004 years during the trip. Now, obviously, that helps if you've got a spacecraft with humans on board, because the travel time is much reduced for them. But it doesn't really help from the point of an Earthbound observer. Still takes the same amount of time. And indeed, you know, if you had an unmanned spacecraft, as we're referring to here, it doesn't really make any odds. But one thing it does mean is that if we were, as a practical effect for an unmanned probe, is that when we accelerate this spacecraft that, you know, normal speeds would take many thousands of years to reach, say, even the nearest star, if we try accelerating that to close to the speed of light, the trouble is the amount of energy required, what special relativity tells us is the amount of energy required is huge. So so I think the problem with fast interstellar travel is the energy requirements really are pretty unreasonable. So you've got to rely on slow interstellar travel. If you're talking about unmanned probes, you've got to ask, why would you bother? What would be the purpose, given it's so slow you don't get any results back from that survey for many, many years? I guess if you think about colonization, one interesting thing is that even traveling at rather low speeds, you know, maybe 1% the speed of light or something, where you might plausibly be able to work out an energy budget that would be affordable, it turns out that, you know, you could perhaps travel to the nearby stars in 1,000 years or so, and maybe you'd be prepared to have generations of colonists on board the spacecraft live and die. If those colonists sort of got to the nearest star in 1,000 years, I guess, and then perhaps moved on, they know how to build these spacecrafts, so they think, okay, we're a bit bored with this new planet, we'll move on to another one, hang around for a few hundred years and then move on, you can work out how long it would take a sort of wave of colonization to spread across the galaxy, and estimates would, you know, you could put that at maybe only a few tens of millions of years. Sounds like a long time to cross the whole galaxy, a few tens of millions of years, but of course, you know, on the lifetime of the galaxy, our sun's been around for 5 billion years, 5,000 million years. So a few tens of millions of years is only a small fraction. So it seems that, you know, if anybody, any civilization ever got to that point where they decided that colonization was interstellar colonization was an interesting thing to do, it seems like they might actually be able to do it relatively quickly. And therefore, you know, that leads to this famous paradox known as the Fermi or Hart paradox. Is if aliens exist, extraterrestrials exist, why aren't they here already? Because, you know, if they thought of colonizing space, they would have colonized space, they would have been able to spread across the galaxy. So, of course, there are a number of answers to that question, and it's not really the place here to discuss those. Perhaps another time. Now, the final question for this month is also from Martin. He sneaked in a couple of questions. He says, do we know more about our closest stars than those further away? Does it matter if a star is 4 light years away or 1,000 light years away when it comes to the information we get when we point a telescope at it? Obviously, you'd imagine that if something was closer to you, you'd be able to find out more about it. Now, that's true for stars in certain circumstances. There's certain properties that we're able to measure more easily. One example is sort of measuring the position of a star and indeed its distance. So you may have heard of parallax, which is an effect, you know, you stretch out your arm, raise one finger, close one eye and look at the position of your finger relative to the background, and then change eyes, you'll see your finger moves against the background. That same effect you get when you take pictures of nearby stars, with the Earth at one position in its orbit, say, and with it on the other extreme of its orbit 6 months later. And that parallax gives us probably, you know, the most accurate distances to stars. Now, that's easier to do the closer a star is to us. You might be able to measure the movement of a star in a binary system just by measuring its position, for example, if it's close enough to us to see that movement. Similarly, the closer stars, closer and larger stars, you might actually be able to use high-resolution imaging to resolve the disk of the star. But actually, in general, what matters most about the information we can find out about stars is their brightness. And it's true to say that if I take a particular star, bring it closer to us, it will, of course, appear brighter, and that will be helpful to us. But often stars spread across a very large range of brightness. Typically, stars are rather fainter than the Sun. The star is actually not that average. It's actually brighter than the average. And in the region of the solar neighbourhood, in the region of space around the Sun, most stars are actually much less massive than the Sun. They're so-called M-type dwarfs. They're sort of cool red dwarfs, less massive than the Sun, and therefore rather fainter than the Sun. So you imagine looking around in space, you might think, oh, well, we know about all the stars that are close to us, and we know a huge amount of information about them. Well, that's not actually true. Because these stars are relatively faint, they're not that obvious. And then we have to determine that they're close to us, we need to somehow be able to work out their distance, and that's not too easy a thing to do. So just for example, there's a project, a collaboration called RECONS, which stands for Research Consortium on Nearby Stars, and they've been trying to tie down really what the properties of the stellar populations are within the closest stars to the Sun, within 10 parsecs or within 25 parsecs or so of the Sun. So that's sort of 30 light years or so away. Now, interestingly, they report that in the year 2000, there were 215 stellar systems known within 10 parsecs of the Sun, within about 30 light years of the Sun. Whereas in 2009, there were 249, so it had gone up from 215 to 249, an extra 34 stellar systems just in the last decade discovered very close to the Sun. Now, in fact, the majority of these stars are these M-type dwarfs, 72% of them. So, in fact, the numbers of M dwarfs have gone up from 199 to 239, whereas other types of star, like G-type stars, like the Sun, there's 21 of those within 10 parsecs of the Sun. And that was the case in the year 2000. It's still the case in 2009. Similarly, white dwarf stars, the remnants of stars like the Sun when they've evolved through the red giant phase, those white dwarfs, there's about 18 known in 2000, and similarly 18 known in 2009. So I would say that whether the distance to a star matters about what you can find out about it, well, it does for certain specific things, but in general, the most important thing is the brightness. And that will be, the apparent brightness of the star will depend on both its distance and its intrinsic brightness. And when you've got a bright star, you can, for example, split that light into a spectrum. You've got a large number of photons, let's say, and that gives you very high signal-to-noise measurements, which lets you determine very particular properties of that star, like its composition and its size, effective gravity, and so on and so forth. So brightness is what matters mostly. That's it for this month's Ask an Astronomer. If you've got any questions you'd like answered, then send them in by the usual routes. And I'll speak to you again next month.
Thanks for that, Tim. So we've reached the part of the show where we usually discuss the feedback from Facebook or Twitter. But as we mentioned at the top of the show, we've been conducting the survey. So, Stuart, you wanted to talk about some of the initial results from the survey.
Yeah, I mean, we had quite a lot of responses. We had more than we had in 2007, which is really good, and thank you. You can still fill in the survey, but you have no chance to win a book now, as we've already picked a winner. However, there are a few comments in the survey that I wanted to pick up on. People suggested ways that the Jodcast could be improved. Thank you very much to all the people who've given us constructive suggestions there. There are a few things that people mentioned which actually we sort of already do, and so I just wanted to remind people about a few things. So one of the comments was that they would like us to have no gaps or ads. Now, actually, the podcast version of the Jodcast doesn't have any gaps or ads in the show. And I think, Adam, you thought it might be someone's listening on Astronomy FM.
That was the only reason I could think of.
Right, so if you're the person who complained about the gaps and ads and you're listening on Astronomy FM, then that's Astronomy FM and not us.
Yep.
So if you would prefer no gaps or ads, you can go to jodcast.net and subscribe to the podcast there. We had a few comments from people about the southern sky or lack of southern sky in the Jodcast for the night sky segment. Now, in recent months, we have been including a part about the night sky. We didn't have one in April because it was the April Fool edition, but we have been trying to include the southern sky, and we're actually talking with some people in New Zealand about having a very specific southern night sky segment for the Jodcast as well. So we're aiming to deal with that issue, which we know is a problem because there is a huge northern hemisphere bias.
Yeah, it certainly is.
There were some other comments. One was about having a contents page at the beginning of the Jodcast, which we would audibly, I presume, say when things were going to happen so that people could skip ahead. Now, unfortunately, as we record this, if you saw us recording in our small cupboard at the back of the lecture theatre, you would realise that we aren't organised to know exactly when anything will be in the Jodcast when we record the show.
Nope.
That gets decided afterwards by whoever's editing.
Yep.
So
having edited together, it's a bit all over the shop until you finally got the final cut.
It is. It definitely is. We can't do that, but what we do to try and get around that is that we provide the separate segments of the show as individual downloads so that you can skip the chatter and us talking about things if you want to. And that was another of the comments in the how it could be improved, getting rid of some of the chatter. So you can actually get rid of all the chatter if you so wish. But also we put in the description in the RSS feed, so in iTunes or your MP3 player, the description for each episode does contain the times when the various segments start. Now, talking about us talking about feedback, in fact, there were a few people who suggested they didn't like listening to the feedback. And we had that comment, I think, back in the 2007 survey, which is why we moved the feedback part of the show to the end of the show. So if you aren't bothered about hearing what other Jodcast listeners have written in to say, you can actually turn off.
Yep.
So
no more science beyond the feedback point.
Exactly. So if you don't like the feedback, then just turn off once you get to us talking about feedback, and we won't be offended. Right, so that's it, really. There are plenty of other things from the survey, but it will take a bit of time to have a look and analyse those data. And that's the end of the feedback. And so that brings us to the end of the show as well. Remember, you can get in touch with us via the website at www.jodcast.net.
On the forum at forum.jodcast.net.
Our videos are at youtube.com/jodcast.
We have a Facebook account at jodcast.net/Facebook.
And we're on Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast. So that just leaves us to say thank you to Max Alexander and to Matt Griffin for all being interviewed. And the interviews were edited by Adam Averson and Stuart Lowe, and the show editor was Chris Tibbs. So until next time, Jod on!
Bye!